Hello and welcome to another On the Hoof podcast for Vets in Practice. I'm Alison Braddock, your host for this series of podcasts, and today I am joined by Alwyn Jones, who is Veterinary Investigation Officer at St Boswell's. Hello, Alwyn.
Hello, hi.
Thank you for joining us. So tell us a little bit about yourself, Alwyn.
Yeah, sure. Thank you, Alison, for having me on here. I suppose I first came up to work for the SRUC, or back then it was SSC, back in 2012, and I worked here in St Boswell's with George Caldo for 4 years, and during that time I developed quite a keen interest in pathology. You know, I liked the postmortems a lot and sort of wanted to progress in that area, and so I left in 2016 to do a pathology residency at the Royal Veterinary College in London, or Hertfordshire. And yeah, during that, I had a great time there, learned a lot, had some fantastic colleagues. And during that time, I sort of got my pathology qualification, so became a boarded pathologist, and then came back here in 2019, so back again to St Boswell's, but this time in sort of a dual role as a veterinary investigation officer and also as a veterinary pathologist. So half my time is here in St Boswell's doing postmortems, mainly on cattle, sheep and pigs, mostly cattle and sheep. And the rest of my time is as a pathologist doing histopathology. So I'm part of the histopathology team that provides histopathology service for all the centres, you know, so all the postmortems that gets done in our postmortem centres, and also material that is submitted from vets doing on-farm PMs as well. So yeah, I'm very fortunate really to be in a role that where I get to see so the whole process through, from seeing the carcass coming in and getting to examine the carcass, and then getting to delve deeper at sort of a microscopic level, you know. And it's sort of a very interesting kind of way of looking at the carcass, and I enjoy it very much. So that's what I do. Yeah, so this is me.
Thank you, Alwyn. So you are a fellow returner to SRUC like me.
I am, yeah. Yes.
And that's really the benefit of SRUC veterinary services, is having people like yourself, veterinary investigation officers around the country who are experts on disease. So welcome. Welcome to the first podcast for us. So what are we going to be talking about today, Alwyn?
Yeah, so I'm going to talk about botulism in cattle, and I suppose this is in following on or in response to a case that we investigated here in collaboration, in particular in collaboration with Rachel Bragg at the Vet School up in Edinburgh. We investigated an outbreak of botulism, and we presented that case at the recent BCVA Congress up in Edinburgh, which we felt went down pretty well. So we felt like it would be interesting to sort of talk a bit generally broadly about botulism in cattle in this podcast, and hopefully there'll be some useful information for vets.
That's great, Alwyn, thank you. So shall we talk a little bit about the disease first and then the case study?
Botulism is a neurological disease. You know, it's seen in mammals, in birds, in fish. It's caused by a toxin called botulinum toxin, which is an extremely potent toxin that is produced by a bacteria called Clostridium botulinum. And that toxin binds to the neuromuscular junction, you know, the area where the nerve kind of interacts with the muscle. And the consequence of that is that in affected species, is that it causes paralysis, in particular. But the paralysis is sort of this progressive flaccid paralysis, and that's kind of the characteristic clinical presentation of botulism in species. But in my career so far, I've come across more than one, you know, kind of a handful of cases of botulism, and even though the textbook talk about this flaccid paralysis, in my experience the clinical presentation can be quite variable. Animals can just die quite suddenly, you know, they can be found dead. They can be sort of just looking a bit dull and depressed, maybe a bit, they could be on their feet, but looking a bit, showing tremors. They could be just downer animals, you know, without that kind of necessarily flaccid paralysis. And but then you can also get these cases when they are kind of the typical flaccid paralysis with the tongue hanging out as well. So the presentation is variable, and it's probably related to the dose in that the amount of toxin that they actually ingest. That's probably the key factor there, as to what determines how kind of how they present.
What is actually botulism? Sorry, I'm talking as a lay person here, and we're presenting for vets. But what is it exactly?
Botulism is the name of the disease, I suppose. But the botulism toxin is like the toxin that's elaborated by the bacteria. You know, so the bacteria, first of all, will proliferate. So there's kind of three stages to the bacteria. For like, there's a spore, which is the bacteria will produce spores that will be shed into the environment, if you like. And spores are incredibly kind of sort of indestructible. They can last a long time. They're resistant to sort of relative extremes of temperature, pH, and extent. They can last in the environment for a very long time. And then you can almost think of it as the egg, if you like. And when the conditions are right, so generally they need moisture, they need the right pH, they need the right temperature, but they also need kind of an absence of oxygen. They need anaerobic conditions for that spore to germinate, and that kind of germinate into kind of a bacteria, which we call the vegetative form. And then that bacteria can multiply, etc. And those bacteria elaborate a toxin called botulinum toxin. And that's the toxin, really, that when it gets absorbed into the bloodstream of an animal is what causes the disease in animals. So there's three stages. You've got the spore, vegetative form, and the toxin.
Thanks, Alwyn. That's fascinating. So is there a pattern to outbreaks? Does it occur on particular farms? Or in situations, in particular situations, how is that affecting it?
Yeah, so most outbreaks, in most cases, there is a source of the botulinum toxin, and usually the outbreaks are associated in cattle, in particular, with preformed toxin. So, and it's usually the source can be, in many cases, there is an association with poultry litter. So, and poultry carcasses in particular, if they are present in the litter, can contain spores. Yeah. Some farms will use kind of poultry litter because it can be used as fertilizer, for example, on fields. So this poultry litter, as opposed to just straightforward poultry manure, so this litter has got the bedding and etc. mixed in it.
Oh, that's interesting.
Now, poultry litter is more of a risk, in particular, if there's carcasses of dead birds or carcasses or even dead rodents, you know, kind of mixed in with litter. Now, normally, like the poultry units will gather these carcasses on a daily basis, so there shouldn't be any carcasses in the litter. But, you know, sometimes they might get missed or they might get buried, etc. So that litter then could, and if it's potentially contaminated, would come on a farm. And it could be used, you know, as to spread on fields as fertilizer, or sometimes it's maybe stored in the field in a pile ready to be used. And I've seen sort of an outbreak where cattle have had access to that, you know, and cattle will kind of, due to the curious nature, will go rooting amongst it, you know. And sometimes they even go down there and sort of find them and eat them. So I think if it's used as fertilizer, then I've seen outbreak of cattle being turned on to those fields too soon after the fertilizer has been applied. You need to allow a bit of kind of ideally several months before you turn stock onto it. And this was the case in this outbreak that we presented at BCVA. The silage fields the previous summer had been fertilized with poultry litter, and we suspect that in this case the fertilizer had then kind of contaminated the silage, and then the toxin had been incorporated into the silage. So we saw a big outbreak associated with silage feeding on this farm, which resulted in about approximately 15 dead calves over a period of about 3 weeks. Yeah, so and we the most likely source in that case was the fact that poultry litter had been applied on the fields between the first and second cut silage, and when they started feeding the second cut silage, they started seeing cases. So it's a risk.
Wow. So you've obviously touched on the case study, but what was the outcome and how was it treated?
There's a number of difficulties I find with these botulism outbreaks. first of all, they can be difficult to confirm. And particularly because, so there's a couple of reasons for that, is when you examine these carcasses from animals that have gone down with botulism, there's no post-mortem findings. You know, these carcasses are generally pretty normal here, so there's no kind of findings on the post-mortem. And when you look at these tissues under the microscope, when you look at these tissues histologically, there's no kind of findings there either. These tissues are generally normal to begin with. So diagnosing these cases of botulism is very much a case of ruling out all your other differentials. So it can take a while to reach that diagnosis. Now, like the clinical presentation is very important, you know, so if they're showing the typical clinical signs, then that can give you a good kind of suggestion or a clue that might be going on. And particularly also if you've got a potential source of botulism, so in this case, an association with poultry, which already kind of raised suspicions, and then the absence of post-mortem findings as well. So all those three things, clinical presentation, point source, potential source, absence of postmortem findings, it's already strongly suggestive of botulism. And then it's a case of ruling out our other differentials, you know. So in our case, we did quite an extensive screen, an extensive investigation, you know, to sort of rule out things like ruminal acidosis, which is associated with feeding excess grain and concentrates, you know, systemic bacterial infections. Our microbiology team did an extensive kind of bacterial cultures, kind of mineral deficiencies like hypomagnesemia or hypocalcemia. Acute sort of neurological diseases were ruled out by doing histopathology on the brain and the spinal cord. I mean, toxicities as well. So through a combination of post-mortem, lack of post-mortem findings and the clinical history, we were able to rule out a number of toxicities like nitrate toxicities or plant toxicities. Yeah, so there was a whole list of differentials we had to rule out before we kind of concluded in the end that botulism was the most likely diagnosis. Now, after saying one thing, there is a test for it, and there is a test for the toxin that you can do. There's an ELISA test that detects toxin type C and D. However,
sorry, Aaron, do we offer that with?
Yeah, no, we don't offer that. No, that goes to another lab. That currently goes to Northern Ireland to be tested for the ELISA. So the important thing to remember about the toxin test is that you can do it on blood, you can do it on tissue, you can do it on intestinal content. So we would most commonly do it. We take a sample of small intestinal content and send that off. However, more often than not, it tests negative in these cases. And that is probably because by the time we come to testing and sampling the animal, the toxin by that point will be bound up to the neuromuscular junction, you know, so it's no longer kind of in circulation. It's no longer in the intestinal content. So it's no longer available to be detected, sort of thing. So it's a very common scenario where we strongly suspect botulism to be present, but we don't detect the toxin. However, we still feel in most cases that we can make a diagnosis based, you know, on the clinical findings, point source, lack of PM findings, and ruling out all the other differentials. There's another test as well, which is more expensive. There's a PCR test, and in the Netherlands, that we will sometimes use. That's slightly precluded by the cost of that test, but we have that PCR test available as well, and that detects a broader range of toxins. So the ELISA test, there's about six toxin types. There's A, B, C, D, E, and F toxin types. Now, most cases of botulism in animals is caused by, not exclusively, but most of them are caused by type C and type D. So if we suspect that poultry was the source, you know, we would tend to just run the ELISA test, which will detect the type C and type D. If we suspect the source is something else, and that there's no association with poultry, and say we suspect that, because there's been massive outbreaks associated with like spoiled feed, for example, spoiled bread waste, for example, where the toxin that's been able to kind of proliferate in that environment, and then that could be associated with some of the other toxin types. And in those situations, we would probably send it for the PCR test. But yeah, but there is two options there.
Thank you, Alwyn. So once you've assessed and you've diagnosed whether it could potentially be botulism, what is the treatment? Is there treatment?
No, there's not a specific treatment or a specific antidote. Most cases die. Something like 90% of the cases is about 90% fatality rate. And the treatment is supportive therapy. Some of them, you know, you can possibly bring back around depending on the severity of the clinical signs, you know, and they might come around with supportive treatment, and that could take, you know, several days. But many of them die, and many of them require euthanasia because of the clinical signs are not improving, and yeah, it becomes a welfare issue after a while. So yeah, there's no specific treatment, fortunately.
So it's a pretty hard-hitting disease, isn't it? I mean, in terms of the farm vet,
yeah,
obviously it's not the nicest yeah. disease to have to treat if it's not that straightforward.
Yeah, I mean, these outbreaks are very distressing, you know, for the farmer and the vet involved. You know, they particularly if they're affecting a large number of animals, and simply because of the time it takes for us to kind of confirm our suspicions, I guess, to begin with, because it can be quite a lengthy process, kind of going through all these diagnostic testing to begin with. So being able to kind of confirm, but also these cases can, you know, after you've removed, say you've got a source of botulism that you suspect, and you remove that source, you know, you could still see cases for up to 3 weeks after that's happened, you know, and again, it depends on how much toxin that one animal has ingested. And I think sometimes, like, some of the contaminated material can maybe sit in their rumen for a while. So it's a very prolonged period. So somebody might be kind of, gosh, you know, kind of experiencing and still seeing animals dying and not being able to do anything specific there and then to stop for 3 weeks. I mean, they will stop eventually. And they do, in my experience, they do stop within about 3 weeks, but it's a very prolonged period, you know, where the farmer has to deal with all this, you know. And like in this case, at the start of this outbreak, there was a lot of uncertainty to start about the diagnosis, you know.
So, Alwyn, just going quickly back to the case study, I mean, how big was the herd?
Yeah, the herd was a large beef unit with a large sort of calf rearing enterprise. So we're talking several hundred. And yeah, the cattle were, over the winter, they were fed silage, and there were multiple batches affected. And clinical signs started when this contaminated silage was fed, basically.
The majority of outbreaks, are they caused by poultry litter?
Yeah, the majority of botulism outbreaks in cattle in the UK are associated with poultry litter. So there is a direct or an indirect link with poultry litter. So whether that is, like I said before, you know, whether it's they've been spread on their fields or it's been incorporated into the silage, or whether they've had access to a pile of it in the field, somewhere like that. But not always, not exclusively. And, you know, there is a possibility of spoiled feed as well, you know, spoiled kind of I've heard of spoiled confectionery waste being fed to cattle, you know, and that kind of been associated with a big outbreak, and spoiled bread waste. Like, kind of, I wouldn't kind of rule it out if there's no exposure to poultry, you know. So, yeah. So
Alwyn, what would be your top tips to a farm vet in terms of preventing botulism?
There is a vaccine you can get. It would need to be on a special license because it's an imported vaccine, but it is easy to get hold of. And I think that cattle, if poultry litter, for example, is being used on a farm, you know, even as fertilizer, then I think it's probably a good idea to vaccinate these cattle, you know, and to prevent this sort of outbreak. That would be my main recommendation, you know, sort of kind of when you're doing your health plan and you know that they're using poultry litter or they could potentially have exposure to it, then to do that. And then the other thing is if they are feeding other kind of foodstuffs, you know, kind of maybe unusual foodstuffs, you know, to be aware of if there's a lot of spoilage, if it's not stored properly, then to be aware that that's potentially a risk as well. Because if you create the right anaerobic environment and the spores present, and the spores can germinate, you know, can multiply and produce toxins. So, but that's maybe that's trickier really to monitor, I guess. But yeah.
So Alwyn, just out of interest, I mean, I know you're based at St Boswells. How many botulism cases have you come across?
Yeah, so I think we've come across maybe 4 or 5 cases in our catchment area over the last 5 years or so, I think, you know, and not in big outbreaks like this. You know, some of them may have been just the occasional animal, but yeah, that's sort of, that feels about kind of the rate we see them. And I suppose cattle are considered very sensitive to it, kind of sort of described as being very sensitive to botulism toxins, or more so, like compared to, they've done studies, I know this is mice, not the same, but cattle are probably about 13 times more sensitive to botulism than mice are, and they're thought to be more sensitive to it than birds are as well. I suppose the other thing to talk about is the food safety implications of botulism. You know, so botulism, it's a zoonotic agent, and we notify these cases to the Food Standards Authority, or the Food Standards Scotland up here. We worked closely with Food Standards during this outbreak, you know, so we notified them early of our suspicions, and there is withdrawal periods you have to kind of apply onto the herd once you've kind of made your suspicion. So basically, like in this case, any clinical cases could obviously not go to the food chain, you know, so they had to be withheld from the food chain. So you need to be realistically, like, probably the risk of you contracting botulism from those animals is very, very low, you know, to be honest with you. But it is a toxin that can affect humans, basically. But food standards obviously take it seriously, you know, and obviously anything that's clinically affected is withheld from the food chain. And in this case, what we had to do was anything that had been affected had to be held back from the food chain for 17 days after the last clinical signs have been shown. That has an impact here. Everything else, anything else that weren't showing clinical signs could still go to slaughter, but they had to be examined, you know, by the vet before they went out. So we worked closely with Food Standards from the start of this outbreak. As soon as we suspected it, we notified them, and they guided us then as to kind of what the withdrawal periods should be on the herd, and what should be done. And they will kind of make an assessment and treat every incident separately, really. So it's difficult to get kind of concrete guidance here, but there will be some withholding to be applied, particularly on affected animals. But the Food Standards, you know, will guide you really as to what to do. But it's an important consideration because it's a zoonotic agent, you know.
So it could be sporadic around the country, but it's still worth knowing about this disease and being aware of it when you're out and about, really. And as you say, health planning with your clients.
Yeah.
And that's a really important point about it being zoonotic, isn't it? In terms of the risk to the farmer as well and the family.
Yeah.
So for our vet listeners, what are the key points that you really want to get over to think about?
Yeah, so I think I would say clinically, they don't always present as this flaccid paralysis with the tongue sort of hanging out that we learn about at vet school. Just be aware of that. You know, they can present from anything from, you know, sudden death to kind of downer cows to some very mild non-specific signs as well. The second thing I would say is to bear in mind that there are no specific post-mortem changes in these cases, and that confirming the disease is tricky, you know, because there is limitation to the diagnostic test available, like I explained before. So that detecting the toxin in the carcass is often not detected. And the final things, I think, if you're dealing with an outbreak like this, is to manage expectation, you know, with the farmer, and the fact that these outbreaks can go on, you know, for a few weeks, even up to 3 weeks, even after you've identified and removed the potential source of the toxin, you know, you can still have cases. So those would be my three things, I think. Or is that four things? So, but yeah.
Well, they're really important considerations. So thank you very much, Alwyn. And thank you for taking the time. And I look forward to having you back on future podcasts. And thank you also to our listeners. Don't forget, you can listen on various platforms. Don't forget to sign up. And as well as on The Hoof, on our website, we're also on platforms such as Spotify. So thank you for listening.